the Cinemaker, Steven Soderbergh. This is episode 16, Eros, from 2004. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
I'm Mike Manzi.
And I am Tobin Addington.
And this is one that, this is going to be our shortest episode yet, I think. This is basically a short film in a quote-unquote movie of three short films. Soderbergh directed the middle one. It makes perfect sense to me that he has, of the three segments, I only watched his, but it makes perfect sense to me that he has the fewest actors and also the biggest name stars. Like, I feel like that's just sort of like what you sort of come to expect from him sort of now. That it's the most, without having seen the other ones, feels the most compact, feels the most sort of condensed and just easiest and quickest and whatever to shoot.
And it's the shortest of the three. Of this sort of sex anthology of some type, I guess. I'm not exactly sure how to explain it either. Like, I'm just curious as to how this movie came into existence in the first place. But I did watch all three parts, though. Did you watch all three parts, Tobin?
I watched the War Kong Wai and the Antonioni parts on Fast Forward. So I have a sense of them, but I did not watch them in their entirety. No. How did the other two match up?
I like them all on their own, but I don't see any common thread between the three of them except for, like, nudity, basically. There's just, I mean, clearly they all have some sort of sexual undertone thematically going on with them, but they're all just so drastically different. The Wong Kar-wai one is about a tailor who falls in love with a prostitute that he makes clothes for, and then I'm not sure what's going on in the third one whatsoever. Some sort of torrid affair between a few people on the beach, but the middle one is definitely the easiest one to understand.
It's just Robert Downey Jr. having sex dreams.
Within a dream. Like,
yeah.
That's the thing. Like,
Inception.
They all sort of have that extra level to them of, like, just weird for the sake of being weird.
So, there's not a lot of trivia out about this movie. I don't know exactly why this happened. I do know that Pedro Almodovar, who did The Skin I Live In and a bunch of other stuff, was supposed to direct the segment, and then he dropped out, and so Soderbergh filled in at the last minute. So this was his first originally penned screenplay since Schizopolis, so 8 years ago. So that was a handful of episodes ago. So this seemed like a sort of a last-minute addition. He never worked, I don't think, to this point, right, with Alan Arkin or Robert Downey. So it's not like he just called up Clooney and was like, hey, I need you for, like, a weekend, right? Like, he never did anything with these guys before.
No,
and I think this is pre-Iron Man as well, right?
Or it
right,
is.
Right there, yeah. So I was thinking Alan Arkin would have fit in great in the Ocean's movies somewhere as one of those
totally older
guys. Yeah, I was kind of getting that vibe. But was the one thing that was kept throwing me about this was I was getting flashbacks to that Showtime thing that he did.
Yeah.
Because it's like a 50s black and white noir kind of, it feels almost like the Maltese Falcon, but this guy's like an ad executive and he's in his psychiatrist's office talking about this dream he had. But I had wished that we'd never watched that Showtime thing because I couldn't get it out of my head. It kept sticking in there.
It also kind of feels like the underneath a little bit, at least in the dream sequence, the dream within the dream, because it's all blue, that it's a blue room and she's wearing a blue outfit, just, you know, very monochromatic for some reason, I guess, depression? I don't know. Nothing's explained here. The one thing I want to say is that I really, this seals the deal for me that I want Robert Downey's patter in every movie. Like, I'm okay hearing him do his shtick everywhere. Like, I'm never going to get tired of it. Like, I feel like if I didn't get tired of it here, I'm never going to get tired of it. Like, I just like to hear him. I don't know what it is. I wrote on Letterboxd that, like, if life was the movie Anomalisa and Tom Noonan was Robert Downey Jr., I wouldn't even mind not finding my Anomalisa because I'd be so in love with this world around me. Just everybody talking like Robert Downey Jr. all the time. So, because he does the same thing in every movie and it just works for me.
Yeah, I can see that. I wrote in my notes about halfway through this film that this felt to me like a real waste of a couple of actors that I really enjoy, that I really admire. I just think that the material is not as interesting as I think Soderbergh thinks it is. And they're doing the best they can. There's just not a lot. I found it kind of static and inert, the whole sort of first. Oh, I shouldn't say the first part. When it opens with what we learn is his dream within a dream of the woman in the blue dress, or the woman who's not wearing anything and then puts on the blue dress. And that I thought was beautiful. There's again, he's using sort of racking focus back and forth as a way to establish intimacy. And it's sort of voyeuristic and the camera sort of swaying back and forth. It's kind of as she sort of, this woman sort of gets ready as fragments of what feels like a dream. And that I thought was really well done. I mean, I sort of wanted more of that and less of being in the psychiatrist's office for what felt like the majority of the movie in the kind of second section of the movie, where I just felt like I've seen performances of so much more dynamism from both of these actors that I was sort of missing that here.
I think what threw me was that they're trying to make like this shift into what seems like comedy. And after that, you know, when he's in the psychiatrist office, I was not expecting it to reach for that in that direction. I thought we were going to sort of get like a straight, you know, analysis of this woman in the blue room in the bathtub thing. And I kind of feel like I might have liked that a little more. Like, I just don't know if the comedy's working for me. It's too irreverent. I'm not sure if the intention is to point out that this is the dream. I mean, Alan Arkin's doing this weird stuff with the paper airplanes and the small and large binoculars, and I'm not really laughing at it. I'm just sort of like quizzically watching along, hoping that there's an answer to the end of this, but there ultimately isn't really an answer. Robert Downey Jr. wakes up for real at the end of all of this, and I guess you find out he didn't invent the snooze alarm after all. It's been invented all along. Like, that's another thing. I thought that's where it was going. Like, after all of this, like, the punchline is, we've invented the snooze alarm, but no.
I feel like, and I have no idea, but I feel like the Alan Arkin not paying attention to the dream is maybe a commentary, like, nobody wants to hear about your dreams. Like, it's not interesting. Like, there is a thing from really, really early on in Always Sunny where Dennis says to Dee, Dee, I'm going to stop you right there. Like, I don't want to hear about anybody's dreams unless I'm in them or somebody's having sex in them. You could say, like, the most provocative dream, and it's just like, this woman's getting out of the bathtub, and she's getting ready, and she gets dressed, and it's just like, ah, who cares? Like, I don't care. I think Soderbergh, I don't know if that's the point or not, but that's maybe a reading of it. And if that's the case, then I'm fine with it.
You know, the DVD box, in describing this segment on the back of the film, calls it droll. And that, to me, was the first red flag that we were – that sounds to me like a marketer's word to say, okay, look, guys, this is kind of funny, but not really funny. But we have to let people know it's kind of funny, so we're going to call it tongue-in-cheek droll, which means it's going to be quote-unquote funny, but nobody's actually going to laugh. And I think that's actually not a bad like descriptor of this, but it does not sound like something that anybody is going to want to watch.
I put this kind of high – not really high by any stretch of the imagination, but on my rankings, I put it – like 11th? I'd rather rewatch this, if only because it's so short. I'd rather rewatch this than like Kafka.
Wow.
I'm liking Kafka. I like it the more I think about it, actually. I'm really into that movie.
I'd rather rewatch this than Kafka, The Underneath, or Full Frontal. Everything else, and K Street, which is not on this list, but like everything else, and also the Showtime thing that Mike mentioned earlier. But I just like it because it's short. It's got actors in it that I like. It's got a very pretty lady, and it's not unlikable. It's just fine.
Yeah, I don't know. I do actively dislike it. I put it at the bottom of the list of the ones available. I would put the Showtime thing after this for sure. That was...
Well, but what about K Street? Would you rather rewatch this or K Street? 5 hours or 25 minutes?
I would have to think about that. I would have to think
Wow.
About that. The only other interesting thing in my notes is that there's one part where Robert Downey Jr. is in that first black and white section, and he's describing. He's already going on this riff, riff about sales and people buying things and what you're actually being sold. And it got me thinking about something that we're going to start talking more in Soderbergh's work, I think, which is his sort of, you can read a lot of his films as examinations of or critiques of capitalism. Now, I know how this begins to sound like we're gonna lecture here, but really, and I don't, not in a way that I think he's, you know, a Marxist or a socialist or anything, but just in the way that he is interested in how the buying and selling of things defines us, and that becomes really big in the first Magic Mike movie, sort of motivating the whole thing. It's the same is true for the girlfriend experience, how that whole sort of the exchange of money for services happens. There, even the side effects, the Ocean's movies are about that.
I think
that.
Bubble as well,
right?
Bubble takes place in the doll factory, if I'm not mistaken.
Exactly. So. And in like the dying Rust Belt in a doll factory. Aaron Brockovich, even his upcoming movie this summer, the Logan Lucky movie. Just, I think he is wrestling with that as a sort of theme, and that to me was the most interesting thing about this, which I guess technically is, Joey, as you're saying, the Robert Downey Jr. stuff, like his monologues here, his soliloquies are probably the most interesting thing in this movie. And I guess, yeah, I would probably rather watch that than 5 hours of K Street. So yes, I'll say this goes above that and the Showtime thing.
That's all I wanted you to say. I also do want to point out that you said the upcoming Logan Lucky, but this is releasing on January 1st. Happy New Year, guys.
Oh.
So Logan Lucky, which everybody now owns on Blu-ray and DVD and video on demand.
And it's awesome.
No, but yeah, I mean, it is sort of, I guess, a pivot point, kind of. And I never really watched the later films with sort of that critical eye. I am really interested to hear, and I just, it's funny to me how different it's going to be, the Magic Mike episode we do here, and then the Magic Mike episode that we do for the newly launched Magic Mike's podcast, where Joe Two and I are going back through Channing Tatum's career. So we're going to look at it from two very, very, very different angles. I'm excited to watch that movie twice. Getting back to what I was saying, the point I was trying to make was that I never watched the later films with a critical eye, but I'm interested now that I sort of know, or it's been told to me, that that's going to be like a key point for him from here on out. Another thing to look forward to. I just realized that I didn't even open my notes for this because I didn't take any like helpful notes because there's not a lot that goes on. I mean, it's just like everything's so blue and then there's Robert Downey and that's sort of the end.
Yeah, there's some interesting stuff in the idea of us having seen something that we don't know is a dream and then having it recounted from the character who had the dream's point of view, and we're then remembering it the way he's remembering the dream, like, oh, I think I saw that part, and oh, was that thing there? You know, like there's that. It puts us in the point of view of the person who's sort of had the dream, in that you only remember dreams and kind of usually in kind of fragments that way. And, you know, this is you know, one of my least favorite movies from one of my favorite directors, from a very, very skilled filmmaker. So it's not, I don't think it's bad. I just don't think it adds up to as much as so much of his work does.
I almost feel like it's too short of a medium for him to make his point in. Like, there's some quote about him later on going over to television and being like, you know, when I retired, telling a story over 20 hours or whatever, you know, 35 episodes is like an invigorating experience in that schedule compared to just having like, you know, 100 minutes or 120 minutes to tell a story.
Right.
And so I think maybe he's just not adjusted to this length yet. Like, I don't know if he has enough time to make his point clearly or say what he wants to say in a way that's like satisfying enough. Like, maybe if he had another 10 minutes like the other two directors used, like he could have taken the reality segment and wrapped it all up a little cleaner. But I do also love Downey. Like, I'm just a huge fan of him, and I think casting him as a salesman, or he's not necessarily a salesman, but he's like a madman type, like, right, Don Draper type, I think that's perfect. Like, I would love to see Downey and Soderbergh do a movie like that, like,
yeah,
with him as like the salesman or something. Like, that would be really interesting. I hope they get a chance to work together if Downey ever gets out of his Iron Man contract.
I don't think I have anything else to say about Eros. I already forgot.
Eros.
Do either of you have anything else to say about this, or are we going to just sort of look forward toward Ocean's 12?
My only last thing to say, which is sort of interesting, is I believe that the movie came together because one of the producers sort of had this idea to bring three directors together, and this is a thing that happens in fiction a lot, where someone will have an idea for like an anthology of short stories, and they'll reach out to all these famous authors and say, hey, let's all write about, you know, divorce or whatever, and then everybody writes their divorce story. And it does have that feeling in those anthologies. If you ever read that kind of stuff, it's the stories are always hit and miss. Like, some are gonna land for it and some are not. As I recall, when the movie was released, they would scramble the order depending on where the movie was playing, in which market it was playing in. I can't remember if that's true or not, but it does make some sense that you would either lead or finish with the big one to keep people in their seats, or, you know, or get them to come to the theater. But I'm not surprised you don't see more of this kind of thing, because this is just not... There aren't a lot of filmmakers who I think can deliver something satisfying in 25 to 35 minutes. I think they need more time.
This also kind of reminded me a little of stuff like The Paris Je T'aime and New York, I Love You.
Oh, I guess that's
those types of things as well. Yeah, except those you get many more segments than just three. They're sort of a little more intertwined. They're all based in the same sort of location.
And they're shorter too. This may be some more of an in-between kind of space or something, yeah.
if I'm not mistaken, this is the last thing Antonioni released. But I've not seen a lot of his work. I've seen some of his stuff, but I also heard that Soderbergh watches Red Desert a lot.
Yeah.
Like he watches that movie almost, well, according to some commentary I listened to like 10 years ago, he would watch it before filming just to sort of like refresh his mind as in the color theory and form and stuff like that. So yeah, it's great that he got to work with someone that he admired so much.
What, did they really work together or no?
Well, or like, at least he got to sort of be on the same bill,
right,
be associated with that. So
right.
That's cool.
And maybe get a new Antonioni movie seen in the United States in a way that hadn't happened since the late 70s. Yeah.
Yeah, the trivia on IMDb says this is his last film. It sounded like, to sort of elaborate on what Tobin said earlier, that the producer really just wanted to work with him again. So they came up with this triptych, this three-story idea. And apparently it was filmed, Antonioni's thing was filmed in English, and then initial test screenings were so negative that they're like, whoops! And then they dubbed over in Italian.
Oh,
so
amazing.
Oh, that's great. They dubbed it in Italian? Usually it's the reverse.
Right. That's amazing.
So that's that. So next week we have Ocean's 12, which is, in a lot of ways, the opposite of this in just about every facet. back to a movie that I've seen before, so that's kind of exciting. But yeah, so any other last thoughts about this, or are we good to wrap up?
I'm good.
Yeah, let's wrap it up.
So for all things Cinemakers, you can go to cageclub.me or facebook.com/cageclub or at cageclubpod on Twitter. You can see all the episodes that we've done. You can see everything that's going to, everything that's going to come out for the rest of this year. Now that it's January 1st, we have a whole new slate of shows, which even might include a new show, wink, wink, by our guest here, Tobin Addington, might have a new show this year. Hey. So anything is possible in the year 2018, if we are all still alive at this point.
Jeez.
I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm underground-dwelling Mike Manzi.
I am the ever-hopeful Tobin Addington.
And we'll see you next time on Cinemakers.